Okay, thank you very much. So I'm going to give a short course, three lecture course on the title here. I'm going to enlarge the window just in a moment. So my plan is the following at the beginning. That will be today. I'm going to talk about the Euclidean case. In other words, this is the classical Fourier transform. You can actually see more or less what I'm going to cover today. I'm going to start with microlocal stuff tomorrow, actually. And why I want to do that? Well, because this is important by itself, of course. It's a classical stuff. And many tricks, microlocal tricks, actually rely on very good knowledge of what is happening in the Euclidean case. I really want to go over the Euclidean case carefully. First, what is the Radon X-ray transform? I'm going to show that in a moment, but first I want to show here the acceptance. I'm not sure why this is not refreshing, but anyway, this is a refreshing, this is the acceptance speech of Cormack, his Nobel Prize. I mean, there's not many mathematical theories that won Nobel Prize, so this is one of them. In disguise, actually, it's Nobel Prize in probably medicine, biology, I'm not sure. Okay, so let's start with the... with the Euclidean X-ray Radon transforms. Well, okay, again, I'm not sure why we're seeing this. This is... Okay, I prefer this. So reference is a classical book of Helgeson, of course, Radon Transform. Last time I looked, it's available online. It's free on his website, the latest edition. Frank Natterer has a nice book on X-ray Transform. And then I have a paper here. I'm going to follow parts of this tomorrow, but tomorrow's material is based on the classical books of Helgeson and Natterer. Yeah. They will, but they are not there, but I'm going to post them on my website and eventually they'll appear on fields, because my files are still not ready. I mean, this lecture is ready, of course, but not tomorrow's. They will be eventually. Okay, so what is an X-ray transform? You take a function of f, which is relatively small to infinity, so that you can integrate it. Okay, so this is, I'm going to make that more precise in a moment. And integrate this function along any line in Rn, if you can. So you see that the function is nice enough, can be integrated. It's good to think of the X-ray transform as a transform that sends a function on the X space, on the usual space, to functional lines. I mean, we're going to parameterize this in a moment, but it's also very easy to think about L as a line, as a geometric object, if you wish. Of course, the direction doesn't matter the way it's written here. If you integrate in this direction, the opposite, we get the same thing. You can parameterize them in several different ways. The most natural probably is to take a point and direction, and then this determines a unique line. Well, it determines a line, but that line has direction, and this line and the opposite one, they contribute the same thing, right? So you should think about this as a way to parameterize line, but if you replace theta by minus theta, you get the same one, the same undirected line. So this is one way to do that. Of course, this is not unique parameterization, because if you take any other point on the same line and the same direction, they determine the same line, of course. So this is not unique parameterization, and this is the non-uniqueness in the parameterization. So you're free to translate the initial point along the line, and it's also even with respect to theta. And up to those two formulas, this is the only non-uniqueness that we have in that parameterization. So very often I'm going to write xf of x and theta, and I'm going to assume that x and theta belong here. I have to remember this. But also, again, very useful to think of this as object that is a function on the set of lines. Actually, that set has natural structure, but we'll see that in a moment. Well, actually, we already saw this. So what will be the motivation? In X-ray medical imaging, so you have a patient, and then what they do is send a source of radioactive rays. It goes through the body of the patient, and the body is not transparent to those rays, which is the whole point. And the intensity at each point in direction solves this transport equation. So this operator here, just this is the derivative in the direction of theta, right? This is directional derivative. So sigma is the attenuation. In other words, when the ray goes through the body, it attenuates because it gets absorbed or maybe even reflected by some by the body of the patient. So this terms is the attenuation term, and then you solve this homogeneous equation. This is very easy to solve. I mean, this is a PD of order one, linear, and it's actually ordinary differential equation along the lines parallel to theta, right? So you have to think of this as an equation of the following type. Again, if you stay on one of those lines, it is an ordinary differential equation of this type. And A is a variable coefficient restricted on each line. And you can solve it using the usual tricks, for example, find integrating factor. And what it is the following. So you assume that at minus infinity is actually not really infinity. So if you just move away from the body of the patient, you have I0, which is some initial intensity. Then the ray goes through the body, and what you measure is what is happening on the other side. And if you solve this differential equation, then you see that this is what you measure, the initial intensity, and it's attenuated by that factor here. Right? It's again simple solution of this equation. And if you you take x on this line, but s goes to plus infinity, there's not really infinity if f has compact support, you just need to go out of the body of the patient, and you basically measure this integral. So this is what you measure. Again, it's just enough to take s to be large enough if f has compact support. And in other words, again, going back, take log of this with negative sign and so on, and then you essentially measure this integral. Well, if sigma depends on the direction, then this is what we have. But very often we just assume that sigma detonation is independent of theta. And if it is independent of theta, this is the X-ray transform. Okay, again, just remove that theta here, and this is the X-ray transform. Okay, and then the problem is how to reduce, how to find sigma, at least of the special class independent of theta, if you're given all those integrals along all those lines. Right? You must have seen that before. So let me draw another picture. So this is your patient. So you had all those integrals, and you want to recover f. And the patient now is a function with compact support. So this is the density in some sense of the body. Okay, so I work on inverse problems, and inverse problems, people, the first thing that they'll do is start counting. So how many variables we have? So is that so-called formally determined or undetermined problem? And let's count the number of variables that we need to parameterize xf. Remember, you need a point in the direction, but the point can move along that line and still gives you the same line. So it's natural here to say, well, I'm going to restrict x to a plane which is perpendicular to theta. Where you put that plane doesn't matter, so zero is a origin is a good candidate for this. So you parameterize lines by, let's say, fix the direction, and then you choose initial point on the plane which is perpendicular to theta. So here you have n minus one variables. this n minus one dimensional plane, and then we have n minus one variables because this belongs to the unit sphere. So if you just count the variables, well, then you see that you have two n minus two variables, and it doesn't seem that you can reduce them in some easy way. The only reduction that we still didn't take into account that your function is even in theta, but it doesn't reduce the number of variables really. So we really have two n minus two variables, and f depends on n variables. Okay, and then you compare those two numbers, and this seems to be larger. But let's see. Of course, I'm always assuming that n is at least two, right? And if you just subtract n from both sides, you see that this is equivalent to the following. Okay, so if n is equal to 2, then this is actually equality. And in two dimensions, this is formally determined. What does it mean formally determined? It means that you have a function of, let's count them, two variables, and you want to recover a function of two variables. It doesn't mean that you can do it, but at least somehow it seems that you have enough information. Again, it doesn't really mean that you have enough information, but at least it looks like not completely hopeless problem. We call that formally determined case, if n is 2. If n is at least 3, then you have strict inequality here. So the number of variables in xf is larger than the numbers of the function, which is m. So if, for example, if n is 3, which is the physical case, you have 4 variables here and 3 here, so you have one more variable that you need. Again, you don't really know that you don't need it at this point, but it seems that there's too much information. And we call that formally overdetermined problem. Okay, and for this reason, applied people don't like to work with X-ray transform in three dimensions. Actually, there are other reasons as well, but this is one of them. And they say, okay, if you're in three dimensions and higher, just work on each plane. You know, integrals over all lines, take some family of lines, for example, this one. And you know all those integrals over all lines in each plane, then recover the function here, go to another plane, and so on. So you can actually reduce the problem to a problem on infinite many, of course, but to a family of planes. And you don't need all lines, you just need lines which are perpendicular to the normal to all those planes. Right? So this is one way to reduce the number of variables, to take some complex of lines that has less dimension. So I'm not going to try to do that in this lecture. This is so-called restricted X-ray transform. If you reduce the number of lines, well, not the number, but the dimension, actually. But it's a good observation and something to have in mind. Okay, what is Radon transform? You take all planes in Rn, hyperplanes, right, given by linear equations, and integrate your function over all those planes. Again, you can parameterize this somehow, but it's usual, it's good to keep that in mind, that what you get is a function that is a function on the set of planes, which is actually a manifold. But at the beginning, you just think, okay, give me a plane, I can give you a number, right? This is the usual Euclidean measure on each hyperplane, and if you try to parameterize them, one way to do that is to parameterize by normal and distance to the origin. Let's say this is the origin, and then we have your plane here. So W is the, well, okay, first this point is the point which is closest to, on that plane to the origin. Of course, then this is a right angle. Right? And then this vector is a normal to that plane clearly, because this is the closest point, and p is the distance to the origin, but not exactly, because you can change the sign of this vector, and then minus p, and you're going to get the same equation. Clearly, if you replace omega by minus that and p by minus that, it gives you the same plane. So each plane without any direction. So I'm not assuming that those planes have actually not direction but orientation. Not assuming that. So just planes, that's it. Can actually be parameterized by two pairs, and they give you the same plane. Right? That seems mysterious, but if you want later to study more general transons with waves and so on, you may want to introduce orientation of those planes to say which is the upper and lower, if you want, part or right or left. And if you want to introduce orientation, then really those will give you two different planes, two different orientations. But right now, you have this symmetry. And then you think of the random transom as the following object. Well, integrate function over the plane, but that plane is parameterized by P and omega. And then you get an even function on this product. Before it was even function of theta only, now it's an even function of both variables. And the problem is given RF to recover F. And now it's formally determined. Because this belongs to R1, and this belongs to SM minus 1, of course. That is true, so we have function of m variables and try to recover function of m variables, which makes it formally determined. So in other words, in the random transform we have less information, roughly speaking, just by counting variables, but not in two dimensions. In two dimensions, the extra transform is formally determined, this one is actually the same. So in two dimensions, all those planes actually lines, right? And this is the origin, this is P, and this is a vector. Actually, I say that this is W, well, not really. I mean, this is W is a unit vector, which is parallel to this, right? So this is one way to parameterize a line in two dimensions. And another way is the way I did it before, x and theta. In other words, we have two different ways to describe random transform, or x-ray transform in the plane, either as x, f before, rf, but they're the same. So for in the applied literature, you can see most often people use this kind of parameterization in two dimensions. First, they work in two dimensions for many reasons. One of them is computational. And instead of working with x-ray, they prefer to work with r. But again, this is just a matter of different notations. Right? I personally prefer to work with XF for other reasons, because eventually I'm interested in generalizing this to geodesics and so on, and then, of course, things change. Okay, so I'm going to go over the basic theory of those two transforms. Again, I'm not trying to cover everything. It's a whole chapter in each one of those books. It represents a very long chapter, actually, but just the most essential stuff. So. This is what I mentioned before, so it's enough to restrict the initial point that I call x before, now is z, to a plane perpendicular to theta, to the origin, for example. But let's define a measure. So I want to compute now the transpose of x, we'll see later why. But in order to compute this, I have to choose some kind of measure. Right now, I know that XF can be parameterized by elements of sigma, but I have to have some way to integrate over sigma. So I have to introduce a measure here. And this seems to be a natural measure. So this is the natural measure on the unit sphere, and then this is the measure on the plane perpendicular to it. I mean, you can actually explain why this seems to be a natural measure up to multiplication by constant. It has certain invariance properties. So there's a lot of symmetry in that space, and this is a unique measure that produces all those symmetries and so on, but I'm not going to that. Okay, so, and you have to remember that each undirected line, which is what we're interested in now, has two pair of coordinates, right? So it's a double coverage. So another parameterization, you may wonder why we need another parameterization. If you want to consider more general cases, set of lines, you have curves related to a metric or some Hamiltonian, then that doesn't work so well. So So here's another representation. Let's say you're interested only in functions in some domain. So they have complex support, and you know that the support is somewhere here. And you think that the domain is strictly convex, which is not essential. You can always make it larger and convex. And then you do the following. So for any point, in any direction, so you take points on the boundary, and direction that points inside. So this restricts the possible directions to half space here. So for any point and direction, integrate along the line that is determined by this point in this direction. And you have to choose a way to some kind of measure. And again, that seems, that the natural measure should be this one without this factor, but I'll explain later why this factor here should be here. I mean, it has certain measure on the boundary, induced by the Euclidean measure, and you have natural measure on the sphere. So this seems to be a very good candidate for a measure, but what they put here is they put cosine of the following angle. So nu is the external normal, and you take this angle and take cosine of it, and you put it there. So why? Well, we'll see in a moment. On the next slide, there will be some statement that says that if you do that, then your measure is equivalent to what we did before. Okay, so now there's a natural map from here to the previous parameterization. The previous parameterization was like this. I'm going to show a picture in a moment. So starting from point here and direction, you can extend this and put, let's say, the origin is somewhere here, and z is the intersection of this line with the plane, and theta is the same theta, of course. And there's a natural map. And let me show this picture. This is basically that picture. So two ways to parameterize the line, starting from this point in this direction, or starting from this direction and point on the plane perpendicular to it. And the important proposition here is that this map, which gives you the correspondence between them, that is an isometry. And the inverse is an isometry. And the isometry is because I put that factor here. So again, the reason for that factor is I don't want this parameterization to be dependent on the surface. Actually, it is dependent, of course, but I don't want what I'm going to get eventually to depend on that boundary. So if I choose another boundary like that and do the same thing there, this is isometric to this, this is isometric to that, so they're isometric to each other. So this makes the formula that I'm going to get eventually independent of that boundary. Otherwise, I'm going to get some very unpleasant factors that depends on the way I choose omega. Okay, I'm going to skip the idea. The proof is very easy. And now we can compute the transpose with respect to either parameterization. It doesn't really matter which one because they're isometric. So prime here has now clear meaning, right? And this is the adjoint. So again, think of psi as a function on the manifold of lines. Given each line, psi gives a number, so it's a function on the lines. And x prime psi is a function on the x space. So from function of lines, on lines, you get a function on the x space. And this is the formula, but I think it's much easier to understand this formula if you think it this way. So you have a point, x, and you want to compute x prime psi there. So you want to compute this thing at this end, x is, let's say, fixed. So consider all possible lines through this point, and each line you know the value of psi. Well, just integrate. So again, you average or integrate psi over all lines through that point x. So this is the way to understand this. And if you compare that with the original formulation of x, there's no prime here, this is the original x, integrate f over all points belonging to a line. So you fix the line on the left, not the x, now you fix a line, and you consider all points on that line and integrate. In some sense, those two formulas are symmetric to each other. They're basically the same, but you just switch points and lines and lines and points. So this transform is also often called a back projection, because the most naive idea is the following. So I want to reconstruct F. We're going to see formulas in a moment, but we say, okay, I want to know what F of S here, but I know this integral, I know that, and so on. Why don't you take all those integrals of all lines through X and integrate over them? In some sense, all the information is supported here, which is not true, of course. You also get, depends on what happens there, but that's why you call it back projection. So somehow you back project to the X space. I'm not saying that back projection gives you inversion, but it's very close to it. We'll see in a moment. Okay, and this allows us to extend X to compactly supported distributions. And the usual theory, of course, is if you have a distribution, let's say F is a distribution, and you want to define this product. And those brackets mean this is the duality in Rn. Of course, you want to give definition of the following sort. This is C0 infinity in the X space, and again, this is distribution, and you want to use that as a definition. Okay, so if this is a test function, let's see, there should be primes, right? Yeah, this should be primes. And, well, let me change it to psi because I used the notation of psi in the previous slide. Okay, so this is a distribution, the X space. You take the X and transform. This is distribution on the manifold of lines. Right? And you want to give this definition. Well, not this distribution, it's test function. Okay, so this is correct definition. If this is C0 infinity, again, on what I call sigma, which is basically all lines. Right? So you want to make sure that this X prime preserves the compactness of the support. Otherwise, this will not be correct definition. Right? Okay, but it doesn't. That's a problem. So why it doesn't? Well, let's say F is here, support is here, and you want to compute X prime. Well, you ought to compute X prime, maybe I shouldn't take F at all, of psi, and psi is a function of compact support. What does it mean, compact support? This is a function of lines. If the line is too far from the origin, then it's zero. Okay, but if you take a point that is very far from the origin, doesn't matter how far it is. If your line is more or less like this, that function is not going to be zero in general. So again, I'm assuming that this has compact support, which means that if the line is too far from the origin, then psi is zero there. And if you take point which is very far, but the line basically goes through the origin or close to it, you're not going to get zero. So compactness of the support is not preserved. And then you cannot really do that to define a joint, to define axon distributions. But you shouldn't expect this to happen because, after all, even if F is a function, it should decay fast enough to infinity to be able to integrate. I mean, if you actually can do this, for any distribution, you should be able to define X transform the function 1, for example, and that doesn't seem to be such a great idea. Okay, but you can do this on compactly supported distributions. In other words, this doesn't work, doesn't extend X to all distributions, but this extends X to distributions that have compact support. And for compact support, that's enough. This takes test functions to functions that are smooth indeed, but not compactly supported. But if F has compact support, then this makes sense. Okay, so this is the whole idea. So you can extend it, but you need the compactness of support. You don't really need it. You may be able to extend it to a larger class, but you cannot extend it just like this to all possible distributions. I'm not going to extend it to distributions, at least not today, but it's good to know that that's possible. Now, the transpose of R. I'm going to skip the details, but you can just compute the transpose of R. Again, psi is a function that lives on hyperplanes. R prime psi is a function of the x space, and this is the formula. And you have to think of this formula in the same way. So you have a point x, you take all planes through x. On each plane, you have value of psi, and just integrate. This is also called gap projection, and you can also extend it to compactly supported distributions. Okay, so the next important theorem in this theory is the Fourier-Weiss theorem. Let me show the whole slide. It says the following. There is a relation between the X-ray transform, and the Rosen transform too, by the way, and the Fourier transform. And the way you can understand it is X theta. You can compute the Fourier transform of f at point zeta perpendicular to theta by doing this. You take the Fourier transform, the x-ray transform in the direction of theta, z lives here, and then you take Fourier transform on that plane. Remember, z lives on this plane, and there's a natural Fourier transform here. This is a linear object, right? And again, takes xf, takes Fourier transform of that, and what you get, the result is f hat for a vector or covector actually, which is perpendicular to theta. And the proof is very simple. So you're basically using the fact that this phase function here is constant on those lines. I mean, put here x equals z plus s theta instead of that, and since I'm assuming that this is perpendicular to theta, if we put in the dot product, this will disappear. Right? In other words, your phase function is independent of s, and then to compute the full Fourier transform, you just integrate first here, and then integrate there. Right? You just Frobenius theorem, basically. Okay, so important corollary of that is, let's see what I have. The other slide immediately implies injectivity, at least for all f's for which this is correct. L1 will be enough. If xf is 0, then f hat is 0. Okay, that means f is 0. Right? Also implies some kind of inversion. We can use that to write inversion formula. It's not probably the best one that you can write, but it's still inversion formula. And also say that what happens if you know xf for a fixed direction, but still all possible initial points. Then you can immediately recover f hat for psi, which is perpendicular to that direction. Now, this has a micro-local analog, and we're going to see that later. I'm going to formulate tomorrow, actually, a theorem that is micro-local analog of that, about the wavefront set and so on. But since we heard today what is a wavefront set, I can tell you even now that if you have even more general transform, and if you have integrals over lines which are parallel to theta and some open set, which is more than I want here, then you can recover the wavefront set perpendicular to that theta. Okay. In fact, for compactly supported distribution, though that implies more. You can recover xf if you know it for, if you know for all theta, that's trivial, right? You already saw that. But let's say you know that for an infinite set of distinct unit vectors. So you have infinitely many thetas and all initial points for each theta, of course. And infinite set is enough. I don't want to go over the proof. The proof is based on the following fact. If let's see, L1. Yeah, I said compact support, yes. I mean, the important part of the proof is that F half is analytic. It's real analytic because of the compactness of the support. And when we know F hat of Xi by Fourier slice theorem for Xi in some in the orthogonal complement of for all theta perpendicular, right? Then you can use you can recover the derivatives of F hat at zero at infinitely many directions, and basically just recover the Taylor expansion of zero, but this is an analytic function. If you recover Taylor expansion, you recover the whole function. So the proof relies heavily on the analyticity of F hat, and it's not very constructive. Well, it is constructive in some sense. You can recover the Taylor expansion, but it's unstable. Well, they have to be distinct. No, I don't think that they have to. They have to be distinct. Yeah, they have to have an accumulation point, but I mean, distinct is important, otherwise it can be just one vector. But, I mean, what you do is actually for each theta, you recover the Fourier transform perpendicular to, on the plane perpendicular to theta. So that gives you, each fixed theta gives you a whole plane. And then even if you are there just on one plane, you still have a whole family of planes. And it gets, I mean, if you just tell, okay, you have infinitely many size, there can be one plane, that can be a problem, of course. You cannot recover anything away from that plane. But for each such theta, you have a whole plane. So that's enough. Okay, so intertwining properties does use sometimes to reduce the wave equation to Riemann transform backwards. So if you take a function and you take Laplace, and this triangle means Laplace, and take Riemann transform, this is the same as to apply the Riemann transform first and take second derivative with respect to P. I mean, this is the derivative with respect to the variable that I call P, which is the distance to the origin. Right? And something similar for R prior, which I'm not going to use. And the proof is pretty much straightforward. You just take the formula and differentiate, integrate by parts maybe. And those are similar properties for x. Take a function, apply Laplacian, and then x transform. This is the same as to apply the x transform and Laplacian on that plane here. And there's a natural Laplacian here, of course. This is a linear object. And of course, in two dimensions, they are the same transform. This formula in two dimensions is. Actually, this one is the same as this one, right? The other one. Okay, so now we're going to the most interesting stuff, how to invert it. There are several ways to invert it. Actually, one of the ways you already saw that. You use Fourier slice theorem and gives you F hat, and then you can invert F hat. Right? Another way, which doesn't use oscillating integrals, is the following. Let's try to imply apply so-called back projection. We're not hoping that this will give us F, but let's see what we're going to get. Well, this is something very easy to compute. I mean, just take the definition of XF, we apply X prime and integrate, do some change of variables, or you can take XF, comma X psi, for example. Psi is a test function, so this is a pretty straightforward calculation. And you get the following integral. Now, this is so-called normal operator. It's always the first step. The good thing about X prime is that it takes you back to the X space. So X takes you from the X space to space to functions on lines. This takes you from functional lines to function of X. So you don't have to deal with this manifold with lines anymore. So you're from Rn to Rn. And this, of course, is a convolution. It's a convolution with something singular, but not too much singular. So just use, for example, polar coordinates centered at one of those points. You're going to see that this singularity is not too bad. If you have, for example, C0 infinity function, this is integrable. So this is more or less exactly where this is still, well, not exactly, but if you make that M, then it's bad, right? It's a strong singularity. This is weak singularity. So this is a convolution and should be a Fourier multiplier. In other words, if you take a Fourier transform here and Fourier transform the result, this should be multiplication with the Fourier transform of what we have here. And of course, again, this is integrable locally, so it is a distribution. So you just need to find the Fourier transform of that, and in the Fourier domain, that will be just multiplication. Well, the Fourier transform, this is relatively easy to compute. Actually, it's almost immediately considered should be like this, but the constant takes a little bit more time to compute. But anyway, it's a constant, which of course is explicit, times that. Okay, so in other words, this is Fourier multiplier. And what it means is the following. So if you take Fourier transform here, this is the same as take F hat, divide by this, right? And in order to invert it, what is D? Probably I didn't introduce D so far. D, this is the standard notation. Which of course is minus I times gradient. And when you go to Fourier transform, this becomes multiplication by itself, of course. Because if you put it under absolute value norm, that I doesn't matter. So in other words, so this is x prime x. In order to invert it, you just need to apply this operator. So in other words, this makes this formula here obvious. Right? So this is the inversion. Take x prime, and then to make it equal to f, you have to apply this operator. Another way to think about this is square root of Laplacian. And how do you find square root of Laplacian? Well, you go to Fourier transform, and it's a multiplication by this, of course. This is one way to define this. So this inversion formula and CN looks like this in two dimensions, which is the widely used case, is 1 over 4 pi. And, okay, so here's the second inversion formula that we saw. The first one was based on Fourier-Slice theorem. And let's see how useful is this. I mean, this operator is a non-local operator. If you ask me how we can compute it, the obvious answer will be maybe not the unique one, but okay, take the Fourier transform, multiply by this thing, contain the inverse Fourier transform. Of course, numerically, that is not a very nice thing to do. And when you multiply by that, when you take Fourier transform, you get function in the whole space. It's very hard to compute, and then you have to multiply by this, take the inverse Fourier transform. So, in other words, it's a non-local operator. It requires you to... Let's go back. It requires you to know that in the whole space. Right? You have to take Fourier transform of this. So you have to compute it everywhere. And, well, it looks like this, of course, but you really have to take X large enough, well, everywhere. Of course, numerical people will not do that. They will just truncate it to some domain. But it doesn't decay terribly fast. I mean, in two dimensions, this decays like 1 over r. So you really have to make computations a huge domain just to be able to invert it. And for that reason, numerical people don't like that formula. I mean, it's a nice formula. It's exact, of course, but they don't like it. And another inversion formula is of this sort. You take xf, this is what we have. The constant is the same, by the way. And you apply, I'm going to give you more details about that, but this is square root of the Laplacian on this plane perpendicular to theta. In two dimensions, this is just one dimensional operator. Again, we're going to see another formula for that in a moment, but the no-local operator is here, and then you apply x prime. So if you compare this in the previous formula before, you had some nasty operator here, and now you have it in between x and x prime, and you may ask me, is that really a progress? Why is that really so much better than the other one? For theoretical reasons, they're basically the same formulas. I mean, I don't see any advantage, but for computation it is. So this non-local operator appears between x prime and x. Let's see why is that better. Well, this is given. It has complex support, by the way, if f has complex support. Then you have to apply non-local operator. There are several ways to do that, which I'm going to show one in a moment, so-called Hilbert transform. But anyway, whatever you're going to do is going to give you a function in the whole space, in principle, in infinite space. But then you have to apply x prime. And you only want to compute the result in complex set. In other words, you can put here some cutoff function which has complex support for free because you know that this is true for f. Now, you really have to compute that thing. In other words, you have to compute x prime restricted on complex domain. Well, you can easily see that you only need to put here complex, only in complex domain here. So in other words, you can put here another complexly supported function because if you start from points, actually the points really are planes, so lines, very far from the origin, you're going to get a zero because of this. So if you think more about this, you see that you actually need to make computations from complex set to complex set again. And that's not very convincing at this point because you still have to use Fourier transform, but there will be another formula in a moment that actually shows that this is really useful. Okay, so in applications, most of the time R is preferred to X, I told you that before. And then let's see what happens with R. So people actually really use this formalism instead of X in two dimensions. Okay, so what is the kernel of R prime R? This is very similar to what we had before, but you see there is power 1 here. Instead of n minus 1 is 1. And the easy way to remember is that in all those formulas, 1 is replaced by n minus 1. Before it was n minus 1, now it's 1 the power. This is still integrable, of course. And this is convolution, but it's convolution with that thing. Before it was minus 1, now it's minus n minus 1. And that gives you inversion formula for the Radon transform. And again, that's easy to understand. It comes from that, right? There's some surprise here. If n is odd, this is even, and then d squared is Laplacian with negative sign. So if n is odd, this operator actually local is a power of Laplacian, which makes it good in some sense. But the most interesting example for applications when n is 2, then of course this is still a bad operator, and it should be because R is the same as X in two dimensions. And now, what is the filter depth projection here? Let's start from the end, actually. Okay, so this is the main result. So if N is odd, what is DP? This is derivative with respect to the variable I call P, distance to the origin. And you just take certain number of derivatives of R, then apply R prime, you get your formula. It's very nice formula here because there are no local operators. You don't need Fourier transform, just integrate and differentiate, and that's it. But if n is even, which is the most common case in applications, what you have here is the following. In two dimensions, this will be just one derivative with respect to variable p. Then you apply this Hilbert transform, which looks like this. PV means principal value, otherwise this wouldn't be integrable. It removes symmetric neighborhood of P, where S equals P, where this, and then you shrink it to zero in a symmetric way. And then you take R prime. And you may say, okay, where did it come from? So if you can consider just this term here, Okay, I'm going to come back to this slide in a moment. If you just consider this term here, forget about this for a moment. It is basically dp absolute value norm to power n minus 1. In other words, those two formulas I showed before actually are versions of that formula. And this is something that you can expect. This is similar to what we had before. But since this is related to, in order to compute it, you have to take Fourier transform and so on, you actually write it in the following way. Just ordinary derivative, and then Hilbert transform, which is just certain integration without oscillating integrals. You don't need Fourier transform for this, right? This is something computationally nice. You still have some singular kernel here, you still have to do some work, but that can be expected. So basically, this is the formula that is preferred, but I'm not a numerical analyst, so don't trust everything that I said too much about the numerics of that, but my impression is that this is the formula that I prefer. And this is the only non-pleasant computation, I guess. The other one is you have to differentiate. Okay, so I have those inversion formulas. And you may ask yourself, okay, how stable is that, and what kind of stability estimates you have? So what do you mean by stability estimates? I mean estimates of this kind. You know that if xf is 0, then f is 0, because this is a linear operator. Uniqueness means injectivity. Well, at least you know that if f is compactly supported, you have 1. Stability estimate is an estimate that tells that if this is small, roughly speaking, then this will be small. Small errors in the measurements will lead to small errors in the reconstruction. To be more precise, I'm not talking about reconstruction, but I mean, this is the best you can hope for. In other words, if your data is unstable, let's say you make error in the measurements 1%, and you know a priori theoretically that that gives you error in the reconstruction, even if you don't know how to do it, but it can be as large as 100%. Doesn't matter how clever you are, your data, if your data is unstable, you have a huge set of S which are too much far apart, and this will be useless practically. Well, estimate like this tells you that small errors should lead to small errors in the reconstruction if you know how to do reconstruction. And you have to define some spaces, and they are not very intuitive, by the way. So G here is going to be replaced eventually by XF. So this is a function on the set of the manifolds actually of lines. And you only take derivative with respect to the z variable. Z variable is the one which is perpendicular to theta, right? And what is missing here are the theta derivatives, and you may ask yourself why, what happened to the theta derivatives, and how there's no symmetry. But actually, even if you include here theta derivatives, this will not change. But the proof is harder. And so the second g is going to be eventually function on the manifold of planes. And you only take derivative with respect to p. P is the variable that is distance to the origin. But you don't take derivative on the plane itself. Again, you can in principle, and nothing here will change, except the constants. And this is the first theorem. It tells you that this part is not really stability. This part just tells you that x is bounded operator in those norms. This is the interesting estimate. You see that you can estimate f a priori by xf. And this norm and this norm are the same. The constant, of course, is different. I mean, 1 over c and c. And the fact that I have the estimates on the right by the same now tells me that this is a sharp estimate. Let's say I can get here estimate with h s minus 10, for example. And that will still be stability estimate, but I want to have the same norm on the left and right, and this is what happens here. We call those sharp estimates, the sharp norms. And the same thing for RF. Okay, what does it tell you? You see, when you go from here to F, you lose one half derivative. Well, that is a little bit misleading because you're on different space, right? XF lives on space of lines, and then you get function set of points, but you lose one half derivative. So in other words, XF, the inversion is unstable with degree of instability, roughly speaking, like one half. You can see that the inversion is roughly speaking one half, taking one half derivative of XF. Some people call that instability. Well, compared to many other inverse problems, this is very stable. So it's, from my point of view, this is very stable. But anyway, you lose one half derivative. Compare this to the Riemann transform, you lose n minus 1 minus over 2 derivatives when you invert. So this is like n minus 1 over 2 differentiations. But that's what it is, right? And this is what I mentioned here. And you can also explain that this 1 is the dimension of each line, and this n minus 2 before you divide by 2 is the dimension of each plane over which you integrate. So those transforms have some smoothing effect. You integrate. You don't integrate over the whole space, but around some objects. And when you integrate, you lose some derivatives, like your objects are a little bit smoother. Well, when you recover them, you should, roughly speaking, differentiate somewhere. So this explanation why, naive explanation why those results can be expected. The proof is pretty straightforward. You have explicit formulas, you just use them and derive those estimates. And I want to show, okay, to remove slides, another type of stability estimates. In terms of X prime XF, right? Compare this to those, we have X and RF here, right? Now, why X prime X? Well, this has the advantage that your function is in the same space as well. It's not in the space of lines, so, okay? It's the first step for inversion in some sense. And this operator is injective if and only if X is. It's very easy, just integration by parts. And those estimates look like this. Again, they are sharp. We have the same norm to the left and right. You have S plus 1 S, so you lose one derivative, but we know that this is Fourier multiplier, actually it's a pseudo-differential operator also, of degree minus 1. So to find that, you just have to apply one derivative, right? And the same thing here. Okay, you may see, what is omega 1? It's a slightly larger domain. You may see, well, okay, but this should be also easy to prove. I mean, you have all those explicit formulas, just use them and estimate them, but there is a problem. Remember, in order to find F from that, you have to apply non-local operator. You need to know this for all in the whole space, and here you have a domain. Okay, so that's the reason I put those question marks here. So the proof is not so direct. Okay, so you can start from your inversion formula and try to get your estimate from here. Then you split the integration in omega 1, which is the main slot larger than omega, and then in the complement. But you don't really need that term. You want to get rid of this term, right? This is what the theorem says. And it's there. Okay, and here's a trick that tells you that actually you can get rid of this term with the following theorem. Let's say I have an estimate of this kind, and I know that this is a compact operator. Then, and also, that's first. Second thing, I know that SA is injective. I know that a priori somehow. I mean, this doesn't prove injectivity, of course. F is zero, it still doesn't. Then it can actually prove estimate of this kind, and the downside is that you lose control over the constant. You have no idea what that C prime is, how it's related to C, but you know for sure that this holds. It's basic functional analysis. Well, okay. And this is the basic argument. So if you take F, which is supporting omega, and restrict it to the complement of larger domain, then what you get is smooth. So this omega 1, so F is supported here, you take the result here. Look at this formula here. F is supported inside, and Y is here, and X is separated from Y. This is a smooth kernel. So the result is C infinity. So in other words, this is operator here that takes F to C infinity functions. And you can easily show that this means that this is a compact operator. So again, the operator from f to x prime xf is compact, which actually allows you to apply this lemma and get rid of this term, and the downside is that you lose control over this constant. So this is how you can prove this estimate, which is the most interesting one, and also this one. Right? So there is a little trick involved. And probably have to stop here. I'm going to start next time with the support theorems. Okay, but I'm going to start next time because I'm out of time, I guess. No. This one, the first one is in Natterer's book. Not in Helgeson, because Helgeson has different taste. For he's not so much interested in that. Of course, he knows how to do it. The second one is a version of stability estimate that we have with Günther Ullmann in.